You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we hope that they would be a source of King Jesus shepherding you. And this summer, College Life is all about stories in all different facets of the word. We believe that life is not just a series of isolated events, but that there is a narrative shape to history, both communally and individually. So on the podcast this summer, we want to tell stories, and we want to open ourselves up to be shaped by and changed by stories. And my hope and my dream and my prayer is that our community would be full of storied people who not only understand the storied nature of their own lives, but who relish the delight of encountering a good story, but who are also fluent in story, both telling stories and hearing or understanding stories. And to get there, we have to practice. We have to practice opening ourselves up to different stories and then learning how to dialogue with them to see how they can shape our lives. And some of the best storytellers out there right now are telling stories through film. And so a couple times this summer, we want our entire community to watch a film together, and then on the pod, we'll talk about it. What story is it trying to tell? How do we know? And how does that story interact with the story of our God? And this podcast is our first attempt at doing just that. And my hope is that in doing this, not only do we become wise readers of story, but we will become better at engaging with culture, and we will get to know our own story even better as we engage in conversation with it. Plus, movies are awesome, and you'll hear more about the rationale for why movies as you listen to the pod, but let's just start here, okay? When trying to understand a film, the story it's telling, when you're trying to understand a film and the story that it's telling, it's wise not to ignore its title. And the more I've been thinking about this film, Just Mercy, the more I've been impressed with the subtle and profound call of the title. It makes me aware of my propensity to focus on merely one of those two words at a time. I have such a weak ability to imagine how both justice and mercy can coexist. But of course, this is what Christians have claimed we see in Jesus on the cross: justice for his people's collective debts and mercy for providing a way to cancel. And I hope in watching this film or listening to this conversation that you have an encounter with the God who paves a way not just for justice and not just for mercy, but a just mercy. And even if that encounter feels uncomfortable, that you wouldn't turn away. That's my hope. Enjoy the pod.
It's never too late for justice. You're the only one cared enough to fight for me.
If we could look at ourselves closely, I might not have the answer. We can change this world for the better. We all need grace. We all need mercy.
Amen. I got my truth back. You gave that to me. And ain't nobody gonna take that from us.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Your Pod and Your Staff. This is our first episode of what we are calling Podcorn Theology.
Why Podcorn? I don't get it.
If you were to flip the third letter upside down, what would happen to the word?
Popcorn.
Popcorn, which you eat while you watch
movies. Oh my gosh.
Well, I am back with my friend and partner in crime of ministry, Miriam Hamilton. Hello, Miriam.
Hello, Peter.
And Miriam, we have a special guest, which I've already spoiled the surprise, but this special guest is not just in Davis, not just the side of the Mississippi, not just in America, but probably in the world, one of the greatest people, top five and not number five. So I would like for you to tell us who we are joined with today.
Oh, wow. What an honor. On the podcast this week, we have Ali Paré with us.
Hello, everybody. Joy to be here.
Yeah, you were just recently a student in College Life. You were famously an art major. I think you and your major seem the most tied together.
Yeah, there's Ali. She studies art.
Yeah, because I was like one of, there was nobody else.
And because you had these famous late night art sessions where you would wrangle all of your friends to help you finish a project. And then it always looked unbelievably beautiful.
Thank you.
And also, you are always our first call when we need anyone to babysit Mason and or watch his monitor while he sleeps.
It's an honor.
So thank you for that.
Also, you are African American Studies minor, correct?
Yes.
Okay, just to be upfront with everybody, this is not the first time we're having this conversation. This is our take two. And just to tell you a little bit about what happened, we had a great conversation. I was stoked. On my way home, I told Katie, man, Allie is just like, she had so many good things to say. This is going to be such a good podcast. And then I went to go start editing it and realized pretty quickly that all of Satan's demons decided to descend upon the audio recording of Allie. And she sounded like she was breathing curses of damnation. And there was just static and repetition. I sent it to some, and for a while we were just going to roll with really bad audio. Then I came into the light and said, let's just redo the conversation.
I wish people could hear it so they just, they really understand.
Yeah. Be like, this is what you could have been listening to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So I want to just to set the table. I want to say a little bit about what we're going to be doing in this episode and why we're doing it. And so we're going to be talking about the movie Just Mercy, which stars Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx. And just so you know, like, if you haven't seen the movie, you should watch it before you listen to this. We are going to act as if everyone has seen the movie. So we're going to try our best not to recap a bunch of stuff, because hopefully you've seen the movie and you remember it. And we don't want to get lost in recapping everything. But the reason we're talking about Just Mercy is because there's this conviction that I have, and I feel passionate about it, and it's not original to me. It's actually connected to some classes I took at Fuller. Two of my favorite classes were these film and theology classes, and it was sort of toward the end of my degree, and I was really just excited, like, oh, it sounds fun to watch movies. It'd be cool to think about theology and movies. Mm-hmm. And I had a certain idea of what I thought that meant. And I thought that meant sort of like pick out the Christian symbols in the movie or the Christian lesson. And even if the filmmaker didn't mean for it to be Christian, we go in and we pick it out and and sort of baptize the movie, even if the movie didn't want to be baptized. And so what ended up happening was I was sort of introduced sort of to a bigger theological claim that actually you can encounter God through your time watching movies, that these stories that are being told in the movies that you're watching can actually be moments where the Spirit gets a hold of you in a non-trivial way. And there's a whole theological framework that we're not going to get into right now. But the classes that I took, the first one was film and theology, and it was by the guy that really did write the book on this thing. And his name is Rob Johnston. And the book's called Real Spirituality, spelled R-E-E-L. What do you think about that?
Clever.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Pretty clever.
Popcorn, a little bit below that one.
In the first class, he has us write a little personal anecdote of a time when we had a quote-unquote transcendent experience watching a movie. And he said over the years doing this assignment, he's noticed that students generally respond in three different ways. They generally respond with, the first camp is that I had this experience watching a movie where I felt like I understood more distinctly a truth that I knew from the scriptures, but I was able to recognize it in a new way through the movie. And I feel very familiar with that. I think a lot of that happened to me in Just Mercy, where it's like, oh, now it feels clearer to me what this scripture meant by watching it played out. And then the second way was that there was sort of this emotional experience that just feels significant and maybe even changes the way that you approach something or approach life, you know? And then there's also encounters where people describe very clearly that it felt like God himself speaking through the film to the individual. And the professor, Rob Johnston, has an experience like this. He watched this movie called Beckett, and I think he was on a path to some totally different career, not in ministry and not with movies at all. And he watched this movie and it just like radically shifted his experience. It was sort of like an apocalypse in the way that Rafik and I were mentioning on the last podcast, this like you're seeing things more clearly. I think he saw things that made him just radically change his life and change his whole career trajectory. And so there's these three sorts of experiences that the Spirit often does or can do when we watch movies. And you know, I literally just had an experience like this. I was on a plane to Nashville to do Haley Barker and Charlie Hunt's wedding. And I watched this movie called Waves, and it is super intense. I mean, it's like not the movie you want to be watching just like right next to someone, you know? It's like you want like emotional space. Like it was super intense, super heavy, and super visceral, like gut-wrenching. And I'm not selling it super well, but it was really, really great, really excellent. And I had this experience because part of the movie seemed to be about parental guilt and a father pushing his son. And through that pushing of the son ends up sort of becoming this monster in a way that you see the like de-evolution of the character. And there's definitely a pattern for me of when I encounter movies, and what moves me is these like father-child stories. And so I was just like sitting on the plane, like weeping and weeping and weeping. And, you know, it's interesting, like, this son was doing bad things. So you could be thinking, well, this isn't something that a Christian should be watching. But at the same time, it showed me something almost by counterexample of how the father loves me and how I want to be with my own son. And then also think about my own relationship with my dad. And it all coalesces for me. And it's like very meaningful, powerful moment. And so like the image of a father becomes almost more crystal clear for me, even watching a cautionary tale. So anyway, I am just convinced that going to the movie theater can be occasions of the spirit really grabbing a hold of us. But I think in order to do that and to sort of enter into that world, we need to watch movies well. And so that's sort of the hope for these kinds of conversations, is that we would have conversations that would model what it looks like to enter into theological conversation with a film. And, you know, Christians have had a long history with Hollywood, and it has not always been a good one. A lot has been in policing a movie's morality. Is this a good movie to watch based on explicitly what it shows us? And the reality is that the world is a dark place, and that to see truth often is to look at dark things. And I would like to move us into a direction of engaging with film and in a way where we are not just avoiding it, but we're also not controlling the conversation. And what I mean by that is that often the Christian is controlling the conversation to fit Christian ideas and images. But what we want to do is be hospitable with our conversations about film. If you think of like welcoming a stranger into your house, and you entertain them and you get to know them, and you want to be learning about what they are all about so that you can engage with them in love. And that's what we want to do with movies. We want to think hospitably. So we want to watch a movie with these eyes of, what is the movie trying to say? What is the filmmaker trying to get across? Like, what are the particular elements and themes that they're trying to communicate? And then once we've really understood those, like really tried to be very hospitable and really trying to understand, what are you saying to me? Then we enter into relational and theological dialogue. Once we've sort of gathered the themes, then we can think, okay, some of these are going to compare and contrast with the Christian story. Some of these are going to affirm the Christian story. Some of these are going to challenge our own beliefs. And some of these are going to even make us believe what we believe even more firmly. And that can be a little bit unnerving, because it's like, whoa, no, we're supposed to have the truth. And so this sort of outside source is coming to tell us the truth. It's like, well, that happens in the scriptures. Like Yahweh uses Babylon. Yahweh uses these sort of pagan nations to teach Israel things. And so what we want to do is we want the film to be the speaker. We want to be the hearer. And our role in this podcast is to tell you what we heard through our conversation about Just Mercy. So in a sense, we sort of have two guests with us today. We have Ali, and we have the movie Just Mercy. But I'm curious to know from you both, have you had sort of a transcendent experience in movie watching?
You know, I actually have. And I want to also mention, I remember we did this talking about movies last summer, and it actually really changed the way that I look at movies now. And I think it's changed the way that I can connect the movies that I'm watching to my faith. And I think about that storyline and the way that we broke down the stories last year. It affected the way that I view movies now. And so if you are hesitant at this point in the podcast to keep going, I urge you to keep going, because it's worth your while.
That's great.
But the film, or I guess it wasn't really a film, it was like a 20-minute video maybe. I have watched it every year in this one professor's class that he's mostly the reason why I chose to pursue a minor in African American studies. But he shows this film called The Revelations, and I think it's by Alvin Ailey. I looked it up.
Came prepared.
Nice.
Right. And it's about like 20-minute long interpretive dance with hymns playing in the background, and it illustrates this story that is super compelling, but it's not really telling you anything direct. And I remember being like so affected by it the first time that I watched it, and it was in class. It just took me outside of what I was experiencing in the moment. It took me into this kind of like spiritual experience, but also just a greater understanding of how I could be affected by movement and dance, of somebody like showing motion through an emotive like movement, that I could be impacted by that rather than it just being somebody preaching to me a sermon or coming up to me and saying something that I really needed to hear. It was something beyond that. Like, it taught me that the spirit can impact us and touch us in ways that we don't expect and that we don't see coming. I didn't know exactly what was going on, why they were doing it, but yeah, that's what came to mind when you asked me what a certain kind of experience that I had with film.
You know, yeah, I had this memory come to mind of this time that my friends and I were like all together, just like having a really lighthearted night, and we watched the movie Wonder. Do you remember that movie? It's like about the...
I watched that one on a plane. I watched that one on a plane and cried just like Peter. Different movies, same thing.
Yeah. And it's a sad movie, but one of my friends, she was sitting sort of like in front of us, and I could hear her like sniffling throughout the movie, but I wasn't sure like what was happening. And the movie ends and we're all like a little bit teary eyed, but she is like weeping, like has lost it. And she starts talking about how like she was crying through almost the entire movie. There was something about this movie that was just hitting her in like a really deep place where she couldn't really control her emotions. And I mean, I've had experiences like that where it's like not a Christian film. It's not like the Narnia, Lord of the Rings, overt Christian symbols movies, but there's something about it where like this truth gets communicated, or there's something about it that feels very healing. And it's helpful to hear you guys talk about that, because as you're talking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, totally. Like there's just something about stories and something about art that can move people in a way that just like a more direct sermon doesn't always have the ability to do.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about this because I've not spent a lot of time like studying film, but I have the human experience of really being moved by the art form. So I'm excited to dive into this conversation.
You know, Rob Johnston and then the other professor, his name is Cutter Calloway.
Cutter Calloway?
Cutter Calloway.
That's awesome.
Well, something that they talk about a lot is that film is one of the places left where really good conversation can happen. Because if you talk about politics, talk about religion and stuff, it gets so contentious and it's so identity driven. But if you sit around a cup of decaf after you go to the pictures, you can talk about real things because real things are in movies. But because it's about this art, you have this common experience to be able to share, and you can disagree about a movie. And you're not as much disagreeing about, you know, that person's identity in the same way you do with like politics. And so that's one of the reasons we wanted to watch Just Mercy, because it deals with things that are happening right now in the culture that are in vogue and are really, really important. And I was really excited to, after the conversation with Rafiq, to just continue having these conversations, because I didn't want it to just be a one-off thing. We just talked about this thing once, race, racism, injustice. And this movie really, to I guess use a movie metaphor, like really zooms in on these issues and gives us a close-up of a lot of this stuff. And so here is what we're going to do. I gave Ali and Miriam these prompts. So here's the stuff to be looking for while you watch it. Basically, it was like, we wanted to talk about like best scenes. We want to talk about the best quotes, like what caught your eye, what caught your ear, because movies are telling stories and they are doing it audio and visually. And so the way that the movie's going to communicate themes is not just through dialogue, but it's also through what you see on screen and what you're hearing, both in the score or in the songs that are dropped. But we also wanted to talk about this category called clanging cymbals. What were the different symbols at work here? Because a movie is different than a novel. You don't have time to unpack everything. So you have to use these symbols both visually and audibly throughout the movie and hint at the theme. And the main goal is that we can coalesce our watching of the movie into some themes, a couple themes that we're thinking. We really think the filmmaker is trying to say this. So it's not a plot summary, but it's the movie is about X, you know? And again, it's like, if you were to go to synopsis, it would say this movie's about Bryan Stevenson, who fights for Johnny D. McMillan and ends up getting justice. You know, that's like a synopsis of the movie, but we want to say, that's not what the movie is about. The movie is about these different themes. And then once we gather those themes, it'd be interesting to talk theologically about those themes. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Makes sense.
In our conversation, we're not going to talk through all the categories. What we're going to do is just talk about our favorite scenes. And in the midst of that, we'll talk about what caught our eye, what caught our ear, the different clanging cymbals that we are witnessing. And but before we get to any of that, I just want to hear some big picture thoughts. What did you think watching the movie? Ali, can you start us off?
Yeah, I watched this twice. And the first time I watched it with my mom, the second time I watched it the other day with a friend. And usually we watch movies for purely entertainment and just like, okay, I'm going to get myself out of reality to be entertained. It's going to be a relaxed evening. You know, it's a rest activity. And I think we need to like challenge that, because movies like this are not that at all. It's something that gets your brain working. It makes you really think about what's going on and how you feel about the different topics that are addressed. And I just think that it went beyond what normal movies do for you. And it addresses so many more things. It's not just the story about Johnny D. and Bryan Stevenson. It talks to a greater narrative of like what's really going on in our society and what has been going on. And you get to see that. And we don't actually get to see all of these things in our day-to-day lives, depending on the community you're in. And so you get to see it in this movie. And who I was watching with the other day, we caught ourselves like, does this actually happen? No way this actually happens. And it does. We just are blind to it. And so this movie is like reality, and it's what we need to be watching so that we can understand the world that we live in better. I think also there were scenes that were just kind of embedded in the movie that caused us to realize, like, again, the reality of what's going on in the prison system and in the racial injustice in our world. And so there was like this one scene that especially stuck out that they just kind of like threw in there, and you're like, oh, I don't really get what's going on, but okay. Yeah. So in one of the scenes that they're driving by to get to death row, Ryan Stevenson is in his car, and you see the scene of the prisoners are working on the sides of the road. The 13th Amendment says that slavery is abolished unless it's punishable by crime. And so you get this picture like, oh my gosh, we're in the 80s and it looks just like slavery. And it's still happening. And because they're in the prison system, there's this idea of the prison industrial complex, where basically our like government made slavery once again by creating this being one of the like fine prints of an amendment. And that was like thought to be forcing Black people back into slavery. And so you just kind of get this picture and you don't understand it right away, but it's in there because it's true, it's relevant, and it's a part of the story. Like, it all comes together. And there's many other scenes like that, that where you're like, oh, this isn't necessarily directly related to Johnny D's trial, but it was happening, and you get a fuller picture of like what exactly was going on.
Yeah, I think that's great. Sounds like what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of one thing that like caught your eye was that like that looks like a chain.
Right, exactly.
And the reason you know that, it's a motif, you know, like in art and in different movies and documentaries and stuff, it's like you're used to that image. So obviously it's not accidental for it to look like a chain gang. And that's just like what's so thrilling about a movie or anything like this, where it's like it is telling us something. It's trying to paint a picture of reality, but by virtue of it being a story, again, it's not lecturing us. Just like you said earlier, Allie, it's it's showing us a reality, and then we are forced to think about then, okay, how does this fit in? Because obviously, if it was just a story about Bryan Stevenson and Johnny D, and just this one particular instance of injustice, then that would be sort of a random scene. But if the story is bigger, if the story is about, on some level, just the injustice of America and race in America, then that scene makes perfect sense, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's really, really interesting. I love hearing that.
Yeah, I also watched it a couple times. And the first time was, I think, mostly just a... they were both emotional experiences. It's an emotional movie, but... it was a lot of like shock and a lot of major disappointments in the movie, like in that first courtroom scene when the verdict totally doesn't go the way that you're expecting it to go. I was just like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, I'm so furious.
Right.
And then at the end, the elation when he's finally free. And then all throughout the movie, a lot of discomfort. And I think that came maybe more the second time I watched it. I was thinking a little bit more about these symbols and these themes. And a lot of it that I was seeing was a lot of social psychology behind how we allow ourselves to perpetuate these injustices, to dehumanize people, and to perpetuate systems and ideologies that allow for the oppression of an entire group of people for literally no reason. Yeah. Just the idea that, like, the color of your skin could actually say something about your value as a human is a social construct that is grounded in nothing, but that we can participate in perpetuating these things. The first time I watched it, I was like, oh my gosh, those people, like, I can't believe how cruel they are. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, oh my gosh, like, we're kind of all those people in some obviously different ways, but that same mechanism is in place in all of us.
Right.
And so I was having to kind of reconcile more of that in myself too, of like, well, I need to be honest too about like, in what ways have I just been passive about those same mechanisms in my own life?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a great movie. It's helping the viewer, helping me see truths that I couldn't just see through an explicit like statement of this is how the world is. Like, it takes the film and the artwork and the story of it all to really move me in a different way.
Yeah. I really agree. I think one of the big takeaways that I kept thinking about when I was watching the movie is a little bit sort of how white people were portrayed. You know, listening to Bryan Stevenson talk, I remember watching the documentary The 13th on Netflix, and Bryan Stevenson in the documentary says, you know, a lot of people come up and say to me things like, for the people living through Jim Crow in the South, like, how did they not see the injustice? And he's like, yeah. No, that's now, you know? And so if you're not doing it now, you probably wouldn't have done it then. And so, I don't know, it's just so interesting. I thought that one thing that was so interesting to me was that, you know, like, this movie is not the first movie in Hollywood dealing with race and for issues of race to be sort of triumphant, you know? And, you know, there's sort of a long strand of movies that try to do this kind of thing. Also a long strand of movies that are just racist, you know, but there's long strand of movies where, you know, racism is overcome, and generally white people really love those movies. And I think there's some complicated reasons for that. And maybe it's that we are really excited to feel like racism is taken care of. And when we watch a movie that is congratulatory of that, we get pretty excited. So like the movie Green Book is that way. There's sort of a white-black relationship, and they become really good friends, and he's sort of a little bit of a white savior. And that won the Academy Award, like, for Best Picture a couple years ago, you know? And so there's these sort of motifs in these racism movies where there is a white savior and racism is overcome, and we celebrate that. And this movie felt different to me, not because there wasn't a moment of triumph over racism and triumph of justice, but it felt like to me, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later too, but that the white people portrayed in the movie, who are sort of categorized as the villains, so to speak, of the movie, but they are not quote-unquote racist in the way that I'm used to quote-unquote racist people being portrayed in a movie. This is my sense. I could be wrong, but usually people who are racist in a movie are either entirely oblivious to the fact that racism even exists, or they are just explicitly racist and are proud of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe like a Klan member, you know? And this movie does some work to tell you a little bit about the motivations that are underlying why these people are doing what they're doing. Like why Sheriff Tate and why Tommy, the DA, are resistant to justice. And what I find so interesting was how aware they seem to be of the progress they think has been made. They seem to over and over again be aware that, yeah, we used to be racist here in the South, but we're not anymore. And so they seem to feel like they're relatively woke, you know? And and obviously we're seeing that they are perpetuating really horrific injustices. And I think that what that does to me as a white viewer is it's harder to distance myself from that kind of white person and that kind of racist, I guess, than it is for me to distance myself from a Klan member. You know, like this is a person who has internalized that there's been progress and has internalized that they are not the problem and yet are perpetuating tons of racism. But yeah, okay, so Just Mercy. Shall we get to some of our best scenes?
Let's do it.
Okay, so first scene I want to talk about was the first time we meet Brian in a very handsome appearance by Michael B. Jordan. very good looking man. So this is the first time we see him, and he is on death row, and he's going to meet an inmate who we just see just for this time. He's an intern right now. He's not quite a lawyer. And I will say this. I will say what caught my eye about this scene was that the first time we ever see Brian, he is sort of behind bars. And not because he's actually in prison, but because the bars are opening for him to come in. And so because there's not a lot of time to tell a whole robust story, often in movies, the very, very, very beginnings will give you sort of all the clues you need to figure out the rest of the movie. It'll sort of give you all the puzzle pieces. The first time we ever see him, it's important that he is opening up jail cells. And like, this is a person who is going to be a liberator. And this is a person who is going to be fighting for the people behind bars and hopefully setting them free, if innocent, you know, and providing justice in a way that has not been offered to them. And so that was the first thing that caught my eye. I just thought that was such a cool way to introduce a character. And it tells us a lot about who he is. And this is sort of at his discovery of who he's going to be. But we're getting the clues as to what and who he's going to be in the movie. What did you think, Miriam? What did you think about this scene? Anything catch your eye, catch your ear?
Yeah, well, I noticed that his whole demeanor shifts like pretty drastically in that scene. Like from the beginning, he's a little unsure of himself. There's this discomfort in him of like, should I be here? And he's also not delivering great news.
Yeah.
He's like, we don't have a lawyer for you yet. And that's bummer news. But then as he connects with this guy and realizes like we have a lot more in common and like, I don't know, we're like connecting on like a very human level. The scene skips forward to the end of their like 2-hour meeting. and they're like leaning in. They have this like really relaxed body posture. It's like if that was the only part of the scene you saw, you would think that they had been friends for many years.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you were saying about how like the opening scene really sets the stage for a lot of the themes and symbols of the movie, that pattern is played out throughout the movie quite a bit. It's played out in how different characters, when they start to get to know each other and to realize they have a lot more in common than they thought, mm-hmm. have a lot more empathy for one another, and how the like reconnecting to their humanity as like people who were made for a relationship just motivates them toward a different kind of course of action. And like that scene really was a moment that changed Bryan Stevenson's whole life course. And I feel like that is similar for a lot of different characters in the movie. They have this moment of connection of realizing this person who I thought I didn't have anything in common with, but turns out we have a lot in common. Because of that, I'm moved towards compassion. I'm moved mm-hmm. towards love mm-hmm. and it changes their course. So I thought it was a moving scene, and you don't quite realize how moving it is until you've watched the whole movie.
Yeah, you know what's interesting too is that the idea of if you were to just see that, you'd think that Bryan Stevenson, and I think it's Henry, I think maybe was the character's name who was the inmate, it looks like they're friends, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, often the beginning of the movie and the ending of the movie are either bookends or at least they're ripe for interpretation. And so I think the last shot of the movie before we get like the end credits is Johnny D and Bryan Stevenson giving a little bit of a fist bump and a little bit of a knowing friendly look, you know, like they're mm-hmm. sort of joking like friends. And that'd be really interesting if that was something we're supposed to tie together, is that Bryan Stevenson is modeling what justice looks like, and it looks maybe more like friendship than we maybe initially would think. So interesting that those two things could be tied together. Allie, what did you think about this scene?
Yeah, as you guys were talking just now, I was thinking about also, that's the first thing we see of Bryan Stevenson with this inmate. We're like, oh, he's totally going to save this dude. We never see him again. And that's just like, it was so disappointing. But you also are just like, well, I guess that speaks so much truth to like the idea of this movie of like, we can want this man to be free. He was coming in contact with so many people on death row and they weren't all being saved. And we don't get to see all of that. And that is just like the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really love this scene. It like triggered things that I have learned about in my most recent class, the last quarter of my last year at Davis. I took Black Church, which was History of African Black Church. And it was a pretty transformative class for me. I feel like I learned a lot more in this class than I think I have in many other classes. Mm-hmm. And again, it was with the same professor that has us watch Revelations. Mm-hmm. He is just amazing. In that scene, first off, Bryan Stevenson comes in and tells him this news. There's like this pause between him saying, you won't be executed within the next year. This is the news that I have for you. Mm-hmm. And there's a pause where you're waiting for his response. We're all like, oh my gosh, that's terrible news. Like, he's going to be executed. That's what that means, is he's going to be executed. But he responds in a way where he is excited about it. He just wanted to see his family. Now he could see his family in the next year, and knowing that he wasn't going to die maybe the next before the next time he got to see him. And just that little news also speaks to what a different situation they are in, being on death row. Mm. Is that little thing that seems insignificant to us, and it seemed like bad news, he responded with such excitement and like happiness. And one of the things that they first connect with after that was that they're both were in the AME choir, church boys. And so you see these two men of faith, like have grown up in a faith background. They're in completely different situations. The AME, which is the African Methodist Episcopal Church, is one of the first branches of the Black Church that started. And it was an autonomous institution for the Black community. Huh. It was one of the first churches owned by Blacks. It was funded by Blacks and therefore could be governed by Blacks. And like they were able to have certain agency that they were not able to have in regular society. Mm-hmm. They were able to vote in these churches. They were able to sit in the pews in these churches. They were able to participate in conversation and create their own rituals and preach their own sermons that were telling them a different story than the sermons that white churches at the time, that white slave owners would bring their slaves to hear this message that was telling them, you're meant to be a slave. You were born into this because God wanted this for you. Mm. And this was not truth. And it was not a story that was giving them the agency to know that they were human beings. And so it's all in the church that all of these ideas that gave the Black community the ability and mobility to become who they're meant to be and to fight against the things that they are being wronged and being oppressed by. And so you see in this, like, the first thread of what gives the Black culture the ability to get through such hard times. And you see it in this first scene as they're connecting on this subject. Mm. And then at the end of it, he's detained by the guard and is pulled away, and he's singing a hymn. He's leaving the room in a hymn, which is, I've had to watch a lot of film from the time of, like, civil rights movement. And in their peaceful protesting, they're being detained, thrown into trucks in massive groups, and they're all singing hymns together. And it just shot me back to that image. Mm-hmm. So even in the moments of hardship and of, like, unfairness, like, he was being treated terribly in that moment just because he had gone over time, whatever it was. But he left the room singing praises to the Lord. It just was a beautiful scene.
Yeah, there's like a lot there, The what caught your ear, like the fact that this scene is ended with this hymn, which I think was Higher Ground. You know, it's like, I don't exactly remember the lyrics, but, you know, the point is, like, you know, when I get to this higher ground, this really should be a moment of despair. You know, this person's, he's told that his death is delayed, but he's still told his death is happening. And now he's getting sort of beaten up because he's had this moment of friendship. You know, there's so much that's stripping away of humanity in this scene. And yet it's just screaming that, no, this person is a human being who cares about his family, who doesn't want his family to see him too close to before he dies, you know, like all this stuff. It's like screaming his humanity, which I think is another thing this movie wants to do over and over again, is loudly and boldly assert the humanity of these people on death row, whom I will admit, I don't think I've ever thought about what happens to people from the time they're sentenced to the time they actually die when they're on death row, you know, and this movie forces you to do that. But also, most of the time a song is played, it's a hymn of some sort. And, you know, that's obviously the symphony of churches. It's hinting at some spiritual and really particularly Christian, maybe motivation or at least underpinning. But also there's deep connection to songs of the oppressed that were sung in slavery fields, you know, and it's like, this is the music of Black history. And then specifically then exactly what you're describing, Allie, of in the Black churches. And so all that seems sort of tied together. There is a lot actually in that particular song, That's pretty interesting. And I do think that when Brian spends time with him, with this prisoner, and then the result of that is that he sort of gets beaten up by the guards, you do start to see, it's like, okay, even bringing dignity, even bringing humanity, even into these dark, dark, dark places of injustice, it is not easy. You know, it's like, it's his helping and it's his friendship and it's his bringing dignity that ends up getting the guy beat up and sort of manhandled. And so you're sort of introduced to this idea, like, even if you want to bring justice to a place where injustice is reigning, it's going to be painful. And you're going to see a lot of pain, and you're going to get really close to pain and hurt. Mm-hmm. So it's priming us to think that this is going to be a pretty hard road. So that, man, yeah, we talked a lot about that first scene, which makes sense. You know, if it's laying the foundation and groundwork for the rest of the film, makes sense that it would be pretty heavily talked about. So, okay, we mentioned this, Alan, you mentioned this at the beginning, but another scene that was really great, I thought, was the first time when he goes to the Monroe death row. He's moved down to Alabama and sort of had this tearful goodbye with his family. And then he is going into his new job, and we see him on the Monroe death row for the first time. Talk about that scene. What caught your eye? What caught your ear? Symbols? Anything?
So we're starting from him driving in, and you're seeing the prisoners working on the field, to end of his visit where he has met all of the inmates.
Sorry. It's sort of a cluster of scenes.
But just so everybody's on the same page, that's what we're talking about. And one thing that caught my eye, and I think this was someone to follow throughout the movie, and you kind of don't realize that you're being introduced to him at the first moment. And this was the guard that we don't even know his name, I'm pretty sure.
You know what's interesting is that I looked at the script, and there's some scenes that didn't make it into the movie. And there's a scene of this guy asking Brian to take a case of his cousin or something like that. And so I think he actually had more in the movie, and it got edited out. I think his name might be Derek, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. Derek. Okay. So Derek, you get introduced to him in this scene, and it's him making Brian Stevenson be, what is it called?
Strip search.
Yeah, strip search.
Yeah.
Upon his arrival, he's asked to go into another room to be strip searched. And it's not a normal thing for a lawyer to come in and have to do that. But because of the color of skin and because the guard sees him a certain way, he asks him to do this thing, and you just are infuriated by this scene. Yeah. But it's accurate. And you see Bryan Stevenson, who is a lawyer graduate from Harvard University. He is top of the top, cream of the crop. He is so smart to have gotten through that and to get through it as a Black man also. Mm-hmm. Put in front of a man who is a guard for a prison, who is exercising his power above Bryan and abusing that power just to humiliate Bryan. And you get introduced to this guard who you hate. You absolutely do not like, strongly dislike, sorry to use that word. You do not like him at first.
Yeah.
But you see him transform, and I don't even think he doesn't have very many lines at all throughout the movie.
No.
But you see this man who is tarnished by his prejudices against Black people, but he changes. He transforms completely by the end of the movie, still in the position that he holds, but hopefully changed forever in the way that he treats the people that he's working with day to day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting because it's like basically there are like really four white people in the movie. Eva, Bryan Stevenson's coworker, is one who seems like she's like total ally. Like she's just fully bought in. Injustice needs to be taken down. There is the DA and the sheriff who seem like the racist prototypes, right? And then there's this guy. We'll call him Derek. Could totally not be his name. But we see him transform. Which is interesting. It's like if we see two ends of the spectrum and then we also see someone going from one end of the spectrum to the other. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's something there. It seems like there's, cool. if it's sort of an invitation, it's like, hey, you can change, you know, it's like, and once you see injustice, you should be walking closer and closer down toward the Eva side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But Miriam, what are you going to say? I interrupted you.
Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't realize until the first time we recorded this podcast that the guard was the same guard we had seen throughout the film. And I had a moment at the end when I was like, wait, is that the same guy that we saw in that opening scene? And then I was like, there's no way because he just changes so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cool to kind of realize that and to see like he was actually transforming throughout the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he tells Bryan that he needs to be strip searched, it was one of those like, don't you know who he is moments? Right. Like,
yeah.
Like, I just want to shake him and be like, wait, do you know who you're talking to here? This is Bryan Stevenson. Just the ability to like dehumanize him so quickly, so readily. Like it doesn't matter all of his qualifications. It doesn't matter that he's a human, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's so easily able to dehumanize him.
Yeah, that's really great. Because it's like the dehumanization is happening across the spectrum. It's not just for the inmates who are on death row. They're not the only ones being dehumanized in this world, but really all Black people are being dehumanized, you know?
Yeah. And it was making me think of the Stanford prison experiment.
Yeah.
Which is a super famous study done in psychology.
Philip Zimbardo.
Yeah, Zimbardo. And it's this like super unethical study that was done where the researchers assigned random participants roles of being either a prison guard or a prisoner. And they had them role play this for like a number of days. And it was supposed to go on a lot longer than it actually did. But they cut it short because it was almost immediate that these everyday people who were not actually prisoners, were not actually prison guards, started to take on the power that was assigned to them. And it changed their behaviors. And so these prison guards started acting like really brutally towards the prisoners. And there's something about just being in a particular role and being told this is what the role allows for you changed their understanding of their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they are taking on a lot of the power of being a prison guard and internalizing the significance of that in their life. And I was just thinking about that, like with this prison guard, we see him like, you know, he's the one with power in this situation, and it changes the way that he views himself and his ability to treat Bryan Stevenson like really however he wants to treat him.
Yeah.
But then it's cool to see throughout the film that he grapples with that and is transformed.
Yeah. Another thing about that scene that is just noteworthy is the fact that we get to see all of the death row inmates for the first time. So we've met in the movie, we've already met Johnny D and been introduced to his story. But we also see Herb and we see Ray, all these people who are on death row, and all the people that Bryan Stevenson will be hoping to represent. It's just really interesting to me how we see Johnny D in that scene, very particularly, which again, Jamie Foxx was incredible as Johnny D.
Yeah,
so I mean, good.
Like, just even like in his eyes, you can just see there's so much of a story there. The first time we see him, he is just totally devoid of hope and is angry and bitter. And, you know, Brian, he's like sort of explaining a story, and then Brian's like, yeah, I bet that was really hard. I know how you feel. He's like, no, you don't, you know. And, you know, you're sort of rich boy from Harvard. You don't know how we live down here in the South where you're guilty from the moment you were born. And basically says none of like who you are matters when everyone who's looking at you is just thinks that looks like a man who could kill somebody. And so he is just beaten down, not just by these horrible events that have happened to him, where he is now wrongfully not just in prison, but on death row, but just a whole life of being black in this environment. And I think just a file it away for later moment happens in this scene where after he sort of denies Brian's help on the case, he goes back to his prison cell and he's led there by the guards and he just voluntarily walks in. And there's another scene later where he also gets brought into the cell, but something entirely different happens. And it's just interesting to think he's in this hopeless state and he voluntarily walks into his death cell, basically. There's just something really powerful about that, of when you are brought into a position of such hopelessness, you accept your hopeless fate. There's no hope for me, so why even try? And yeah, I'll just walk into my cell, you know? And it just creates a little visual motif for us later when something different happens, and it's just really powerful.
Mm-hmm. And it ties in this theme that you guys had been talking about of dehumanization, is like losing your own self-image. You have the loss of hope as well. And so he walked in that moment, he lost sense of who he was. In the later scene, he had regained that sense of who he was and who he really was. It was an innocent man and a father and a husband. And so he was fighting. He was fighting for his sanity, his humanity.
Yeah, and it's interesting because at the end of the movie, in Bryan Stevenson's big speech to Congress or whatever, he talks about like hopelessness being the enemy of justice. Mm-hmm. And he said that hope allows us to push forward even when the truth is distorted by the people in power. It allows us to stand when they tell us to sit down and to speak when they say be quiet. And in this moment, we see the hopelessness of Johnny D. And so he is sitting when they say sit down, and he is being quiet when they say be quiet, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like then if by the end of the movie we're saying hope is what gets us to stand and not be quiet, then it's like, then we know that his journey will be one of being reintroduced to hope, which seems like it's going to be a big theme of what this movie is trying to say. It's pretty good stuff. We meet Herb too, which I think Herb in and of itself is almost a symbol for this movie because, you know, Johnny D and Ray are innocent, like legitimately innocent. And Herb is guilty. Like he did the thing that they are accusing him of. He planted a bomb that killed a girl. So it's like he has done a horrible thing. And yet it's not just the innocent people who have quote unquote dignity, but it is even the guilty have dignity. You know, not to jump to our conversation later, but it's like they're, you know, Christians would say they are little images of God, images of the divine. And they haven't tarnished that beyond repair. And so we are introduced to this character, Herb, who we're going to love, you know, and he is guilty. And that's really a powerful thing. So let's move on. There's these different scenes with all those inmates we just talked about where they are talking to each other from cell to cell. Because there's a lot of them, we won't dive into them individually. But I think that just before we move on, the real heart of the narrative comes and the most life comes from these three characters in prison on death row, forming a friendship and laughing and having humanity and counseling each other through hard times and understanding each other and having empathy. And so it just matters that the life that we see almost most fully lived is this friendship between these death row inmates. And so this juxtaposition of death and life seems really important. And again, seems to assert that these people are human beings. And so I think those scenes, we can kind of clump them also into sort of some of the best scenes in the movie. Okay, so I mentioned at the top when I was talking about like how white people were portrayed in the movie that I wanted to talk about another scene where this was happening. And so another scene that I want to talk about is this scene where, you know, Brian has just realized that there was a witness that could show that one of the testimonies that got Johnny D convicted was just totally made up. And that witness ended up being bullied basically into not presenting their case before court, whatever. And so Brian's upset. He goes into the office and he finds both Sheriff Tate and the DA there. And Sheriff Tate, basically in talking to Bryan Stevenson, he tells this story about the family of the young woman who did get murdered, the murder that Johnny D has been convicted of, and talks about how, you know, they deserve to feel safe and they're calling me worried every day. Like, there's no way that this criminal is going to be back on the streets, right? And sort of saying like, do you really want to be the person that brings this family this much pain and wants to reopen these wounds? And I feel like there's two things that were super interesting to me in that. And the first was this narrative of what is keeping justice from being done. It's a fear of things being unsettled. You know, they say over and over and over again that people are going to be angry with you if you bring up this case again. People deserve to feel like they're safe. And a case is mounting that the thing that stands in the way of justice is fear and anger. Like, there's fear that they'll be unsafe if Johnny D gets unleashed back into the community. When in reality, it's like, well, if he didn't do it, that means that the killer is still out there. And that should make you pretty fearful. But the other thing is that Sheriff Tate looks at him and says basically to Brian Stevenson, I know how desperate you must be to fulfill your fantasy of who we are down here. Just a bunch of corrupt Southern racists framing Black people for murder. And I just think that's so interesting. It shows me that he is aware of the narrative about himself. Like, he is aware, you probably think I'm racist because I'm a white Southerner, and that means that I'm always, like, locking Black people up for no reason. It's not like he's unaware of that narrative. He is aware of it and thinks that he's not that. And that seems like a more insidious thing to me, and seems probably closer to, I don't know, maybe how I feel a lot of the time. So it just, again, it's just painting a different kind of quote-unquote racist in a movie. Is not an internally and externally racist person, but it's a covert sort of racist person who can tell you what he thinks you think he is, and then has distance from that because he's, you know, it's like, well, you probably think I'm this way, but I'm not this way. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I noticed that there are a lot of stories being told. There's a story that Sheriff Tate is telling about how Brian Stevenson probably sees him and who he is in this narrative.
Yeah.
And then there's a story that he's spinning that if Brian Stevenson is fighting for Johnny D, then he's obviously not on the side of the victim. That the truth is that he's guilty. There's no question about it. And so if you're fighting to liberate him, you must be like trying to antagonize this girl's family.
Yeah.
And I really admired the way that he was very quick to recognize the lie in the story. Like, he saw that it was being manipulated. And he made that comment about how your job is to fight for justice.
Yeah.
And fighting for justice means like you need to review the evidence again. And just that he was able to sort through the narratives. And I think that's often so hard to do. Narratives can be so persuasive. They can really move us and they can make us really confused.
Mm-hmm.
But to have the confidence in your conviction and the focus in your goal to know, if I'm a person who is fighting for justice, this is what justice looks like. And this story is not aligning with that goal.
Right.
And the power of that in being able to be steadfast in his mission was really key.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also in this scene, I think they introduce a clanging cymbal. They start the movie out with news report that they introduced this idea that this town is where To Kill a Mockingbird takes place. And so in this scene also where he is talking with the sheriff, at the end of having their conversation, he also is like, don't forget to check out To Kill a Mockingbird Museum.
Yeah.
And it's ironic that this is the town that To Kill a Mockingbird was written in, and because of the story of To Kill a Mockingbird, of Atticus Finch being the lawyer that gets Boo Radley out of accusation of him and...
Yeah, yeah, well, he doesn't get Boo Radley.
He doesn't?
He doesn't get Boo Radley's not the one on trial. It's like the... It's the, I don't remember his character's name. In that news report, they say, this is where To Kill a Mockingbird has written a story about a Black man wrongfully convicted and a heroic lawyer who saves him. And so that's like the beginning of the movie. And it's like
the synopsis for this movie.
Yeah, the synopsis for this movie. And they even call this To Kill a Mockingbird Museum one of the great civil rights landmarks of the South. And then Tommy tells Brian, you can actually go stand exactly where Atticus Finch once stood. And it just seems like, just like you said, the irony is like, No, like Brian is standing in sort of the symbolic place of Atticus Finch stood already. He is fighting to get a Black man wrongfully convicted off death row. And so he is embodying this story. It is so interesting. And the irony is like that Brian is fulfilling the sort of narrative To Kill a Mockingbird in a way that this community thinks that it already has. This community is very proud of this museum and is very proud of the place it holds in the South, it seems like, and just in civil rights history. Like, we've already learned our lessons because of To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's like, well, no, you are the one standing in the way of the Atticus Finch character getting the justice that they deserve. It is like dripping with irony, you know? They think of themselves as progressed because of To Kill a Mockingbird. They haven't learned the lesson. You know, they're repeating the same mistakes again and again and again. It reminds me of this this quote I recently heard from an indigenous Christian leader who was talking about sort of injustice. And he says this. He says, you people of European descent tend to think of events occurring on a timeline. So an event that is distant on the timeline is distant from you. But we indigenous peoples think of events primarily occurring in a place. Whenever we are near that place, we are near that event, no matter when it happened. For us, places hold stories. Places become sacred because of the stories they hold. And that was Jim Baer Jacobs who said that. And the fact that this is taking place on the same soil of To Kill a Mockingbird feels like it's like, well, if you learn the lessons, then this could be a really redemptive space. But the story is telling us the lessons have not been learned. And so the same injustice and racism that was in the soil then seems to be in the soil now, you know? And just because it took place a long time ago, they think they're beyond it. But the story is trying to show us, like, no, that this place still holds this power. And it's a really interesting symbol.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating. And it reminds me of a thought I had while I was watching it that just I was struck by the statement, it's like one of the great civil rights landmarks of the South.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was the intent of that line, but I was immediately thinking, like, wait, no, it's not. Like, maybe it's one of them, but like, there's a lot of really notable civil rights landmarks of the South that are not spinning a very kind narrative about white people in the South. And it seems like that's been totally brushed over. Like, we don't want to talk about those things, but like this landmark that like kind of speaks more positively about our story. And just in the, you know, the last few months with the BLM movement, really, really coming into the consciousness of this whole nation. Like, we are, and I am, being more intentional about really exploring, like, what are the wounds and what is the real story of racism in America beyond just slavery happened once and now we're getting better. You know, like, there's so much more that we need to understand. And if we don't face those demons, then we can really easily fool ourselves into thinking that we've come a long way because a lot of time has passed since slavery. But we are in the same place where a lot more trauma and oppression has happened beyond that. And we need to really confront it.
Right. The To Kill a Mockingbird symbol, I think, is really interesting throughout. The next scene that I think is really one of the really crucial ones is the first time we're in court with Johnny D. And Miriam, you had great thoughts on this last time. So.
Yeah, the scene was infuriating, but also just so clever. Like, Ralph Myers is on the stand and Brian Stevenson is questioning him and the audience is primed to think that he's going to speak the truth right away, like this is what he agreed on, and that it's so obvious that he didn't do it and this was a false testimony, and so obviously the court's going to rule in their favor. But you see him like immediately start to waver and you see this just like this fear in him, like he's so uncertain. And like the scene beforehand where he had been talking with Brian Stevenson and saying like, okay, I'll speak the truth about what happened, he's just got a totally different demeanor. Yeah. And Brian Stevenson has this brilliant idea when he starts to realize that he's not going to follow through, where he can see him making eye contact. He can see Ralph Myers making eye contact with Sheriff Tate. Mm-hmm. And he walks in front of Sheriff Tate so he can't see him anymore.
Yeah.
And it's as if you can actually see a connection being broken between them, like a literal like line or rope connecting them that he just severs. Mm-hmm. And then he asks him, do you know who Walter McMillan or Johnny D is? He's like, yes. Is he in this room? Yes. Can you point him out for us? And he's forcing him to instead make a connection with Walter McMillan.
Yeah.
And in that, he's like released from this fear that he has that has been holding him to this lie, and instead is able to connect with Johnny D and have compassion for him. And that gives him the freedom to speak the truth, which is ultimately what liberates him. He's still going to be imprisoned. And he knows that he might actually face the death penalty because like they still have power over him. But it's not the power that really, really counts for the freedom that he experiences internally. And from that moment on, it's like he's like a different person. You know, he has all this confidence. And like once he says it, it's like the truth has set him free.
Right.
And a visual was like almost like visceral. Like you could almost like feel the connections.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, if we're sort of gathering themes, seems like we've talked a little bit about the idea of asserting people's humanity. And also the thing that's keeping that from happening is fear.
It's fear, right?
And so don't look at your fear right now. Look at justice, look at truth. So we sort of see both of those themes sort of colliding. It's like in order to see someone's true humanity, you might have to look away from your fear, which of course is scary and of course is risky. And it's sort of what is required of achieving justice. Mm,
yeah,
that was good. Preach.
This is a big one. Let's talk about the execution scene that happens. So we see Herb who, like I said, we've gotten to know, and we watch him learn about his execution and then watch it happen. And this scene was, well, I'll say this. I think this is the type of scene that I could imagine, and this is sort of a straw man argument, so it's just like, this is maybe inappropriate, but I could imagine some people watching this movie might think this is too much. Like, we can get the point without seeing this. And it's, we don't need to see someone die. That's not appropriate for my kids or whatever. And yet I think it's super crucial. And curious to know what you all think about this scene. I think this is my favorite scene in the movie and really dialed me in. So what did you think when you were watching this scene? Like, what caught your eye, caught your ear? What was your heart doing?
I think you're so right in saying it was crucial. And I think it was crucial for the viewer, for Brian. It was crucial for everyone involved in that scene. Like, Brian Stevenson was transformed by this. The guard was transformed by this being his first execution that he saw. You see it in his face when he looks up at Herb, and like, he looks pretty devastated to see that this is happening to Herb. And Brian, like, he had to be there. He had to see that happen to know what he was working towards to get people away from. Him coming into death row the first time, when he first comes in contact with the guard, his demeanor is confident in what he's doing. He's excited to start his job, and he's walking upright with all of his dignity. And leaving that place after watching the execution, he completely shifts in the way that he's walking out. He's slouched and defeated. It's like he went through that experience with Herb, and he comes out a completely changed person because he had to watch somebody who he really cared about getting out of that situation. He had to watch him die. And yeah, it's crucial to everything that we've kind of built up to that point, and it changes everything for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I totally.
I had a what caught your ear moment with this scene when he requests that the song that's played during his execution is The Old Rugged Cross. And that is kind of a callback to what we were talking about earlier about the symbolism of hymns throughout the film. And The Old Rugged Cross is about Jesus's crucifixion. And the connection there, like, I don't want to be making those like an inappropriate overt like connection to Jesus's execution here, but it seems undeniable. Like, Jesus is crucified with this like mechanism of torture by the state. And here we have Herbert, who is actually guilty, but he is being executed in a really similar way. And he chooses this song that's playing and it's just like heart-wrenching. And then along with the song, you start to hear the clanging of all of the other inmates as they start to, oh my gosh, it's like heart-wrenching as they start to bang on the prison walls just so that they can reach him, so that the sound of the clanging would travel through the vents and he would know like he's not alone in it. And it's just this mix of like camaraderie and we are with you, we see you, we are suffering here with you, like we will not leave you even if we can't go where you're going. And then he's asked, do you have any final words? And he makes a statement that I find there's a lot of parallels to like Jesus's last statement of like, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. And Herbert says, I hold nothing against anybody. And it's just this moment of like release of I'm forgiving and I will choose to be liberated on my own terms. Like, even if you can kill me, you can't take my dignity. You can't take the freedom of my mind and my heart. And all of the sound is rising. And then it just goes silent, like right before his
execution. Yeah, I don't remember that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. In the silence, it was like, he is really alone in this. They can do what they can to suffer with him, but like, he's the only one who's going where he's going. And there's nothing that you can do to take away that pain. All of the music and the sound in that scene really moved me.
Yeah, it does a lot to get you to feel what it wants you to feel. And, you know, it almost starts with Brian going to Herb in like the last moments before he gets taken away to be killed. And he is walking into this cell with this condemned man, and Herb asks him to pray for him. And Brian Stevenson puts his arm around him and prays for him. And just as a pastor, to be honest, that scene was very affecting to me because I have to have this fear that I'm like a peacetime pastor, you know? And I was so inspired by Brian going in and drawing near to pain and drawing near to death and drawing near to someone who he can't save or fix and still being near. And, you know, I've heard Brian Stevenson talk about the importance of being proximate. If you want to really deal with these issues. You need to be proximate. You need to be close to the issues. You can't deal with them from afar. You need to know people. You need to get to know people's pain and open up your life to that pain. And it's interesting, like there's that scene where Eva, who again is his what's it called? Brie Larson. That's who it is. Brie Larson's character. Says to him, she said, I've heard a lot of lawyers say it's never a good idea to get too close to your clients. She says, distance is healthy. But working with you showed me that that's a bunch of baloney. You choose to get close to every one of them and you love them like family. And when your family is hurting, so are you. And so we're seeing Bryan Stevenson be proximate to pain and be proximate to injustice and not run from it when he has failed, so to speak. You know, I thought that was so powerful. And I think is probably another theme to gather is that in order to achieve justice, the move is to go closer to it. So I think all that, I think the reason why it's such a crucial scene and why I think it's necessary, and I think my favorite scene is that I think it's the time when we are just not allowed to look away from the injustice. We're not allowed to look away. And it's so much easier to look away. But we are forced to be like Bryan Stevenson and get close and to see it for what it is and to see injustice unmasked and to be really drawn into it. And
like that moment when the guard tells Derek, yeah. Oh, it's your first time. Like, don't look or you'll yeah. lose your mind. And he chooses to look, like he chooses to see and to like open his eyes and to allow himself to be moved by it.
Yeah. And I was reading an interview with Bryan Stevenson about the movie. And the question was, what do you hope for this movie to do? And Bryan Stevenson said that we've been so divided by the politics of fear and anger that it's easy to stop caring about things that we should care about. He says that it's easy to tolerate things that we shouldn't tolerate. And the way you combat that is to get people closer to inequality, to injustice, to things that are unfair. And that's what story making can do. And that's what films can do. And so it's just this almost like sacred moment where, again, like the curtain is peeled back on reality. We watch injustice and we watch someone watching injustice and how much it changes him and thus should be changing us. And so that's why it's my favorite scene. I think it's where all the themes coalesce and we really see the story for what it is. And so there are some other scenes that are great. We see Brian apologizing to Johnny D for not getting the job done, so to speak. And Walter or Johnny D tells him, hey, like, I heard someone say the truth. And so I got my truth back. I'm feeling good. We see Brian going to confront Tommy at his house. And it's very satisfying. Like, tell him how it is. And then we get the courtroom scene at the end, which we've already talked about everything that is at place in that scene. But it's, again, it's a coalescing of everything. It's where the movie sort of scales up. And Brian really says, like, this is not just a story about Walter McMillan. This is a story about being Black in America. And we cannot say that we're a just nation if this is how we treat the rich and guilty better than the poor and the innocent, which is that Bryan Stevenson sort of catchphrase. So anyway, I think those can be included in the best scenes. So that is it for the scenes that we are going to talk about. And
wait. I feel like you should have included the scene where he goes and he meets Johnny D's family. Like he goes out of his way.
Yeah,
that was notable also because Johnny D, in that moment after he had met the family, that's when he changed his mind about letting Bryan do his case because he did this one thing that like lawyers don't do, which is go out of their way to get into the story. And so once again, like this theme of getting proximate is introduced again because he's actually putting himself in the family and in the situation and getting the whole story so that he could really put himself in this case. And then it's also one clanging cymbal.
Yeah, there you go.
That we missed. Yeah. But is throughout the movie was this idea of handshakes and
physical touch.
He reached out his hand to shake Johnny D's wife's hand and she goes in for a hug and it changes the demeanor of that interaction was going to be one where he was welcomed completely and fully into the family and into their situation. And he goes in, and also this provides like some comic relief in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, oh, just a few family and friends came along to hear what you have to say. And it's literally the whole town in that little house. Yeah. And there's one woman who fills up the iced tea like every 2 seconds. Yeah. And you're like, no, he's fine.
It was so funny.
He took like one sip and there's like maybe a half inch of
she fills it up again. He's like,
yeah. And the woman in the back is like, you had me at it won't cost you a penny, you know. So there's just all this like you get a sense of what the family's like, and then it does introduce the handshake and physical touch, which Peter had talked about with the arm around Herb in
for
his execution. And then there's also when Johnny D is getting liberated, leaving the jail, he's touching all the inmates, all of their hands are just out for him to shake and that physical touch of him coming out of being liberated and having an interaction with all of the people that he's been standing side by side in these cells with.
So it's like one of the things the movie wants to communicate is that everyone's a human being and deserves a dignity. It's like, what's one way you can show that? It's when you extend physical touch, you extend a hand, it dignifies and it's like, I'm with you. And in that scene too, when he's leaving Johnny D's family's house, like he shakes every single person's hand.
Yeah.
And if you remember when he goes to meet Ralph Myers, he extends his hand to shake. Again, it's like, even though you are a villain at this point in this movie, I'm still going to extend my hand to you because you're a human being. And Ralph Myers doesn't shake his hand at first.
Yeah.
When he's still stuck in all that he has done to perpetuate the story, it seems like there's something holding him back from seeing the dignity of every human being.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Maybe like shame.
Yeah. And I was struck too during both verdicts. So when the verdict went against Johnny D and when the verdict went for Johnny D, Brian Stevenson put his arm around him and either comforted him or celebrated with him. You know, and again, it's like this affirmation of his humanity. That's really good. Thank you for saying that, Ali. I appreciate that. And I think that we're safe to say some themes that we've gathered are that justice requires getting proximate. Even like you said, Johnny D was like, it's not your fancy suits. It's not your degree that makes me want you involved in my case. It's the fact that you went to go meet my family. You got proximate to the pain. And we see that over and over again. And injustice lives where we are governed by fear and by anger. That the thing that's keeping justice from happening is fear, and that needs to get broken so that we can see the true humanity of people and the assertion of every single person's humanity and dignity because of that. Yeah, the movie's about a lawyer and a wrongfully convicted man, but it's also about these things, which I think we get when we really listen to the film. And so, you know, we're intentionally not leaving a ton of time for theological reflections because, you know, we've already done it along the way when we've listened and heard from the movie. But I do think there's some space for some theological reflection. So, Ali, Miriam, was there something that caught your attention when you try to put these themes into conversation with our story? How do you think they talk to each other?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about this earlier, but I think the most prominent thing that I saw in it was this connection of like Jesus is suffering here and just being reminded of like, there is another experience of oppression that I do not have. And my privilege has actually kind of removed me from understanding some of the depth of the gospel and the significance of Jesus's own suffering, that he has suffered himself and he is with those who suffer. And you see that in the way that Brian Stevenson chooses to get proximate, and he knows that will bring hardship for himself. And then when Herbert is being executed, just the parallels there of like, in your suffering and oppression, you have a special form of communion with your Savior who has also suffered with you. And you know, it wasn't like I'm learning something new about who Jesus is, but it was a reckoning for me of there's something that the privilege that I've experienced has actually not allowed me to understand in the same way. And that as a follower of Christ, the significance of suffering with people and understanding the significance of Jesus's own suffering is foundational to what motivates us to fight for justice and to be kingdom people.
Wow, that's super interesting. There's something about being close to suffering that feels particularly well suited to our story. It's like the American story is one where we want to get as far away from suffering as possible. We want to be in comfort and security. But our story is the one where we take up our cross. Our story is the story of a crucified king and then inviting us to a cruciform life. And so there's something to be gleaned from and gained from getting close to suffering. It's there where you might see truth in a different way than you see from sort of your ivory towers. That's really interesting, huh? Ali, do you have some theological reflections?
Yeah, most of my theological thoughts about this stemmed a lot from, it's a poor excuse of a comparison, but I was thinking about how Brian Stevenson's character being in the profession that he's in, he was doing it all for justice. He wasn't really getting anything from it. He wasn't getting a large sum of salary. He doesn't have any love interest in this movie. Like, he's doing this purely because he believes in what he's doing and believes in the people that that are on death row, that they don't belong there. And so what I terribly compare this to in my own life was thinking about how I did summer staff my freshman year in college and at Woodleaf. And I was folding laundry for 3 weeks. And boy, was it pretty miserable. I didn't come in contact with very many people. I was cooped up in this laundry room folding sheets all day, and it removed me from realizing like what I was doing actually mattered. And so I had to realize that like every sheet was going to count, and that this was like the Lord's work in that moment, like what I was doing was going to matter to somebody and was going to matter to those campers that they had a folded sheet on their bed or a clean sheet on their bed. And as far removed as that is from what Bryan Stevenson was doing, it's just made me think about like he was suffering a greater multitude than I was, but he was really doing something that he was called for and that our world needs, because the Lord is just. And so Bryan was doing something that the Lord would do if he was here himself.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's so real, you know.
Yeah, that idea of justice and seeing justice done, I think that was the thing for me that felt overwhelming watching the movie and felt overwhelmingly theological and overwhelmingly spiritual. And, you know, I have read verses like Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness or mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Or I've heard Amos 5 from the famous Martin Luther King speech, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And I love that the Christian story speaks to that because it feels like it insulates me from guilt. You know, it's like, oh, I know that Christians have done this before. And so I get to sort of like just attach my wagon to theirs and say like, oh no, I'm a Christian and Christians have participated in injustice, but we got Martin Luther King, we got Bryan Stevenson, we got people who do this, so I'm fine, you know? And I think because of that, like I don't have a great picture of justice. And I think a lot of that is sort of like what Miriam was saying and what you were saying, Ali. It's like, I haven't felt the pain of injustice. And so I don't have a yearning picture of what it looks like when injustice is overturned and when justice prevails and when justice would flow like a mighty stream. You know, it's like, I'm like, okay, well, that could happen. It couldn't. It doesn't affect my life very much. And why I cherish this movie is that it showed me why I should be longing for this. And it showed me what it looks like when justice is finally unleashed. In this movie, essentially, like that release when he finally gets the verdict overturned, it's like this dam was built up of all this justice, you know, the mighty river of justice. And it finally gets to be released, finally gets to overwhelm and overflow. And I was able to be brought in to experience that the way it should be experienced, as opposed to just reading these texts and being like, oh, that's really interesting, but not having it be something that moves my heart to yearn and moves my heart to long for. And so I feel closer now to that truth, having watched this movie, and I feel grateful for that. And one thing that movies can do is they can speak prophetically. And in a way, it's like, this isn't a Christian film. I don't know if he's a Christian filmmaker, but it's not marketed as a Christian film. But yet it is telling me, Peter, you need to check yourself. Like, you say that you follow this Jesus, and yet are you governed by fear and by anger? Or are you governed by the way of the king, which is the way of justice? And I know that I'm governed by fear. I know that. And I think I said on the podcast last week, like I was scared of how people were going to respond to that, which is maybe normal, but I was really nervous. Like, how are people going to hear this thing? How are people going to hear this thing? Maybe I shouldn't say that. And even though I still feel like I'm looking at Sheriff Tate and not able to always say and speak out for justice because I'm worried about the disruption that it'll cause. And I feel like what this movie shows me is actually by doing that, I am ignoring a strand of my own worldview. And so I feel like it's tapping me on the shoulder and it's saying, Peter, you should believe your story all the more. You should live into your story all the more. And I feel grateful for that. And then obviously just the every life has dignity. That is our theology. You know, that is the Imago Dei that, like we mentioned before, every single person, regardless of any qualifier you could put in front of it, both that one can change and what one can't change, they are still an image of God and they bear this inherent dignity. And we shouldn't be apathetic about that. And it seems like the journey that Johnny B goes through is that he gets stripped of understanding that in any way. Like he gets stripped of his humanity and then he's slowly given it back. And you sort of think about, what would it be like to be stripped of my holy and divine moniker, the despair of that, and then to be given it back? I just think it's a worthy thing to think about, you know, so I don't take that for granted, but that actually becomes the lens through which I see myself and the lens through which I see other people. Are they an image of God? Yes. And so they deserve dignity and they deserve my love and respect. And so there's more ground to be covered there, but this movie does open my eyes and I hope it's opened your eyes to not just issues happening in the world, although I hope it does, but also to our story. And if you're a believing person, and hope it draws us to live even more fully into our story. And So thanks for having the conversation with me, you two. Do you want to end with a little quick quarantine corner just to get people through these quarantine times? We thought that maybe quarantine would be ending, but it looks like it's here to stay for a bit longer. And so what we are doing, as you know, at the end of the podcast is giving people a little bit of, hey, it's what we're doing in quarantine to get us through. And so here's our recommendation for you. And so I'm going to go first. Because it's summertime, you know, you got watermelon and stuff. You got different fruits of succulent nature. And so flies are very attracted to all things summery. And I'm just going to tell you something that's going to change your life. Okay, but really fast. You obviously want to murder these flies because they are pests, right? And chances are you have a fly swatter or one of those electric tennis rackets to try and kill these flies. And I'm telling you, you don't need them. You don't need these tools. All you need are these two hands that you have right here, okay? And I'm sure you've tried to maybe clap to kill a fly before. Here's the deal. You're too slow. Okay, you're too slow. Flies are way faster than us. But we have better brains than the fly, and we know that they cannot fly without lifting up off the surface first. So what a fly does before it can like go forward is it goes up. And so because you're too slow, you need to anticipate the movement. And so if you want to kill flies, what you have to do is hover maybe 2 inches above the fly, then clap your hands, boom. You're going to be like a fly murderer. So
that's amazing.
That's my quarantine corner, is have the enjoyment of protecting your home from the flies by hovering 2 inches above them and killing them. That's it.
You know, I don't know if I've ever killed a fly with my bare hands. I just like, well, I didn't know that technique, so I'm sure that's part of it. And also, like, it seems so gross. I just would rather like shoo them away than have them smushed in my
hand. You want to shoo them away and then have them come back like over and over and over again on your skin and feel like it's crawling on you?
I know. I don't want that, but it seems like the lesser of two evils.
I'm not here for that.
Allie, how about you?
Yeah, let me hit you with another one. So puzzles.
Puzzles are
Puzzles are underrated, and our house loves them. We've probably gone through, I think, 3 in the past 2 weeks, and their 1,000-piece puzzles do not go lower than 1,000. Otherwise, it's just, why are you doing them? That's child's play.
1,000-piece puzzles are intense.
Hey, but come on, we're adults. But my thing is, you have to do it without the cover.
Yeah, this is one of the crazy things about you.
This is one of the first things I learned about you.
Yeah, and so I don't think I knew this was just something that people did until like this year or last year. I don't know when I found out. When I started doing puzzles with this house, I think. They're like, why aren't you looking at the cover? And I was like, are you kidding me? No one does it that way. Turns out everybody looks at the cover.
Because I'm telling you, we like ourselves.
I have been doing it.
We're not masochists like you. You'd probably rather have a fly on you while you do a puzzle because it's more annoying.
Do not put me in that category. All I'm saying is you put yourself in this position where you're starting a puzzle. It's a challenge. Why are you doing that? Why are you looking at a cover? I just don't get it. So I'm telling you, don't look at the cover. It's much more fun. It's way more of an experience and adventure. It's about the journey, not the destination, right?
Wow.
So
wow.
I'm just saying, don't look at the cover and do a puzzle. They're amazing.
That's awesome. I was actually doing a puzzle the first time I watched Just Mercy.
Are you serious?
I'm serious, but it was a 500-piece puzzle. But I did it all by myself.
Amateur.
Hey.
Miriam, what's your quarantine corner?
I'm a little embarrassed because it's a TV show and I sometimes stick my nose up to those for quarantine corner. But it's a really good one. I don't know if you guys have heard, but on Disney Plus, they have Boy Meets World.
Oh, Boy Meets
World. You can rewatch it.
And Girl Meets World.
Who really cares about that?
Whatever.
I watched it when I was really young and I didn't appreciate it then. And rewatching some of it now, it's like quite good. The writing is very clever. So,
how do you feel about the name Topanga?
It's the first thing that came to my mind.
I think it's a great name.
Imagine thinking, that's the name we're going to give her. Topanga.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's hopefully nostalgic if you watched it when you were little, but even if you didn't, check it out. It's great, and it's a good little piece of cultural history for you.
And we can have like a unified universe where you could be watching Boy Meets World, you could be doing a puzzle, and if there's a fly that comes to join the party, just hover 2 inches above that sucker, and you're no longer invited.
Kill it, and you're good. Yeah.
So that's quarantine corner. All right, that's it for the pod. Thank you, Allie, for joining us. This is super fun.
Thank you for having me.
A killer debut.
All right, that is it for your pod and your staff. The first episode of Podcorn Theology is in the books. And what can be said about a couple of friends and conversation partners who get up not once, but twice to have a conversation like this. Thank you to Miriam and thank you to Allie, whose podcast debut was off the charts. Allie, you are the Zion Williamson of College Life Podcasts. Thank you, of course, to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung. Your music, as always, is silky smooth. And very seriously, thank you to Rob Johnston and Cutter Calloway for gifting me a lens through which my faith can be bolstered and challenged and stretched through the dark room of a movie theater. I have immense gratitude. And if you have any other movie suggestions for future Podcorn Theology podcasts, please don't hesitate to reach out. But before we go, let me say this. College Life, we love you more than the totality of comments, jokes, and snickers I'm sure Michael B. Jordan must have dealt with growing up with a name like that. See you soon.